is a PhD student on the Life of Breath project, talking about dyspnea and intentionality.
Hello everyone. Okay, so Javi's very kindly introduced me. So this is a little bit about my background. I just started a few months ago. I'm new to projects, so be kind to me. My background, well, I did a philosophy undergraduate degree and a master's. The dissertation I focused on the critique of the biomedical model of depression using an interdisciplinary approach, but you know, generally it was philosophy. Now, whilst I was undertaking this, I realised it was all very well having the theory behind all these thoughts and actually criticising the biomedical model from a theoretical, philosophical standpoint, but actually I thought I need to practice what I preach and see what it's like practising mental health care. So I did lots of volunteering and did some counselling courses, and then went on to do a primary care mental health qualification in the north of England and worked for a Lancashire Women's Centre as a low-intensity cognitive behavioural therapist. Now, the reason that I tell you this is so that you can understand what I'm going to talk about and understand that actually I am going to talk about practical and philosophical considerations in dyspnea, which is breathlessness, clinical term for breathlessness, and the phenomenological concept of intentionality. So, yes, my clinical experience was treating anxiety, panic, depression, and also these were comorbid with many other physical health conditions. Now, the problems that I came across that have led to me working on this PhD include the limitations of the step care models. So in step care models, in any biomedical models, you may have an ill person who comes to you as a mental health practitioner and says, I'm suffering from shortness of breath. Apparently I've got this panic disorder, but honestly, I sometimes feel like I can't breathe. I can't control it. What am I going to do? Can you help me? Can you cure me? Well, obviously, it's not as simple as that. What we were finding when we were having these people coming into the clinic is we worked within a charitable organisation that was funded by the Improving Access to Psychological Therapy setting. And because of the charitable side of what we were doing, we didn't have to treat them in a GP clinic, which people have issues around stigma and being recognised by people, etc. We could utilise other agencies in-house that we provided. So the Women's Centre had a very holistic model, and a model that I think is really important to presentations of people with panic disorder that's comorbid with COPD, and actually treating the whole person instead of just treating them as a disease entity, which is a common criticism levelled at biomedicine. Okay, so whilst I was up there, we worked with domestic abuse agencies, so we had referrals from them. We had referrals from probation services. We had people with substance misuse problems, social service referrals. The reason that all this stuff is relevant is because, again, their issues, whether it was panic, whether it's panic comorbid with COPD, for instance, and again, smoking when you're very, very anxious might actually make you feel worse, but this was people's coping mechanisms, and this was things that we had to think about when we were treating these people. So we had these wonderful women come in, and they were like, my doctor's just giving me these benzos to take, these different medications, and it was becoming apparent that the clinical presentations, including the cognitive behavioural method that we were taught at university alongside our clinical practice, was missing something. You know, we would be told people will have these anxiety physiological responses, they'll have behavioural responses, emotional, cognitive responses, cognitive distortions, irrational thinking, things that in philosophy we might have heard in philosophy of mind, for instance. But The meaningfulness of these conditions were completely overlooked. So some of the women who came to us actually suffered from anxiety, not because if they were domestic violence survivors, something terrible had happened. There might be other factors involved in this. So for instance, I'm going to give you an example of one lady, I'll call her Jane, that's obviously not her real name. Jane came to us and she'd been referred by a domestic violence agency, and they were like, right, okay, she's got anxiety, she suffered a really violent incident about a year ago, and she's off work sick. So the clinical scores that we have to use under the IAP service, and whether you're in a charity or you're actually in the clinic, are things like the patient health questionnaire 9, the work and social adjustment scale, which is, you know, if your treatment, your therapy is successful, you'll get people back to work, or you'll get them in some sort of further educational program. Well, within 6 sessions of working on her anxiety, yes, she went back to work. Treatment a success? Absolutely not. 4 months later, she came back. She was very, very distressed, and it came out that actually, even though she'd suffered from this terrible incident, historically, the job that she was in, the stress that she was under in this particular job, had actually contributed to the anxiety getting overwhelming and forming into this panic disorder. So, you know, you might think, well, that makes sense, you know, we're looking at the social factors, the cultural factors, factors that are very important in phenomenology. But actually, the meaningfulness, the intelligibility of her disorder was actually completely covered over by the fact that we were looking for treatment outcomes as a success, getting her back to work, and there was no room for her to be treated holistically, to be respected as a person, and to explore the way that she was feeling and the contributions to living in this particular area, very deprived area in Blackburn, all these social factors, cultural factors, factors around her religion and her ethnicity that were contributing to her disorder. So the picture is very, very complex. So that's a little bit of background, probably far too much than I should have gone into. So basically, I'm talking about the limitations of the step care models. So interpersonal, social, cultural factors are theoretically recognised, but again, the interventions are not always sufficiently developed. These problems, as I hope I've explained, reveal deeper rooted issues within medicine, governmental policies. So the government are very much, yes, social inclusion, we've got to address criminality, we've got to get people involved in the community to redress what's going on, and then they cut the funding and, you know, everything that's obviously been going on in the past 5-6 years. There's other issues, issues within medicine, gaps in knowledge about this, yeah, about breathlessness, which I will talk about. There's a lack of understanding, a lack of communication between mental health practitioners and, for instance, GPs in connecting up, treating the person, because one practitioner will treat the physical health issues and the other is treating the mental health issues. And actually, one person, for instance, may have COPD and very, very, very severe panic disorder, which makes sense because the extreme feelings of breathlessness or any sort of episode that they've had that have led to A&E will lead them to then go and develop this. It, you know, there's a massive correlation between chronic lung or respiratory disorders and anxiety and depressive disorders. So actually, there needs to be better communication between practitioners. There's also this dogmatic metaphysical commitment to scientism. I'll go into that a little bit later if anybody wants to hear about it. So with Jane, we could see that meaning and significance was stripped from her understanding of her disorders. So actually, is it possible that instead of being a mental disorder, what she was going through was a reasonable response, a rational response, which would reveal problems in living existential conditions, these considerations, you know, gender issues. It's just such a rich field to explore. Okay, so what are the solutions to all of these issues, all of these problems? Any suggestions would be absolutely welcome. Please, I've only been doing it a few months, so that would be bad. Okay, so philosophy has the answer. Philosophical analysis, as you can see, and phenomenology more specifically, I would argue, are ideally placed to illuminate, describe, and explain the first-person experiences of breathlessness, which medicine typically ignores or doesn't attend to. Medicine's treating the symptom, medicine's trying to reduce breathlessness. Look for the underlying pathology, which is, you know, its proper place, absolutely, but the subjective voice, the experiences of the person are covered over or completely not even, you know, attended to. And where this manifests itself as a problem is if we consider COPD, again, a main part of this project area. People with COPD, and you know, the conditions that come under this umbrella term at least, often feel shame and stigma because it is a smoking-related illness. So there's obviously a certain element of people feeling responsible for their conditions. So people with COPD, it's been found that if they're treated in a holistic manner with mental health interventions such as mindfulness, as well as pulmonary rehabilitation, there's better outcomes. There's actually better treatment outcomes. So why isn't there more funding? Why isn't there more research in these areas? That's one question. So not only that, I'd like to move to understanding the onset and maintenance of dyspnea in mental, physical, comorbid disorders, which requires an attendance to the person's subjective experience. So yes, the subjective, objective divide between the different practices and between mental health and physical health practitioners always does come into play. And bridging that gap is, you know, part of what I would like to investigate. Also, it's required that we attend to the life world of the patient as describable through the concept of intentionality, which is a phenomenological concept as well as one in philosophy of mind. Just by considering intentionality, we will also be looking at structures such as embodiment, being in the world, etc. They will be implicated. I don't have time to talk about them, and have discussed many concepts already that, you know, absolutely fascinating and relevant. Okay, so I'd like to move on to breathing and breathlessness. So Jane and Javi and James Dodd recently published an article in the Lancet Respiratory Journal, and they were talking about, you know, how an account of the phenomenology of breathlessness is lacking, as is the philosophy of breathing. This is part of what our project is investigating. So again, the subjective-objective dichotomy in medicine is ever-present. One example of this is studies or even objective pulmonary function measurements, which are the same in patients. So we could have patient A and patient B who both suffer from COPD, and even though their objective lung function measurements are exactly the same, they are experiencing suffering and distress, report these horrible experiences to a different degree. So how is that explainable by medicine? How can that be explained? Also, people with panic disorder, a mental health condition, can suffer from really hideous dyspnea. And meanwhile, somebody who does have, a massive rate of breathing difficulties will report that actually they're not suffering, they're not really distressed. So there is this element of subjectivity, objectivity that needs to be described. So that's a few of the problems. Why phenomenology? Well, the reason that I am using phenomenology is as you may or may not know, it's a methodology that enables description. It suspends our usual metaphysical commitments to objective terminology, to other descriptions and explanations that prevent a full account of the reduced and the altered life world of these patients with mental and physical health conditions related to breathlessness. So, phenomenology's focus is on embodiment, action, intentionality, interpretation. As Matthew Broome and Matthew Ratcliffe previously argue, phenomenological description and interpretation is powerful in mental health practice. So, obviously, the question could be, why phenomenology? What purpose or what utility could it have in medicine? We're looking at evidence-based practice here. Well, as they say, the key to understanding many alterations in the overall structure of experience that occur in psychiatric illness is an appreciation that all experience incorporates a changeable sense of the significance of things and of one's own possibilities, which is tied up with our bodily phenomenology. A lot of the work that these researchers have done, and many, many other researchers, have actually utilised phenomenology and provided evidence that phenomenological description is useful in particularly in psychiatric descriptions. Okay. So, moving on very quickly to what dyspnea is. Okay, so dyspnea is a term used to characterise a subjective experience of breathing discomfort that consists of qualitatively distinct sensations that vary in intensity. The experience derives from interactions among multiple physiological, psychological, social and environmental factors and may induce secondary physiological and behavioural responses. Now, this definition here seems to incorporate what I'm saying is needed. We need to consider the physiological, the behavioural, the cognitive and the emotional, the social embedding, the cultural embedding of people, such as Jane from the north of England. And this is in order to treat the condition, to give descriptions of what's lacking in our approaches and in our knowledge, but also to give a voice to the person who meaningfully relates to their disorder. Okay, so as part of this project, I would like to use pretty much everyone's knowledge in here. It's an interdisciplinary contribution to this project. The reason that I'm saying this is I would like to achieve these aims, and this could be absolutely, you know, too hopeful and ambitious for myself, but these are the sort of things I want to investigate. So first of all, to shed light on these experiences that will foster greater knowledge of dyspnea and understanding of its impact on those with these disorders, and also to lessen the impact of their comorbidity, as I have said, in physical and mental health conditions, the relationship of breathlessness and panic is just, it's absolutely huge. The impact of these kind of things is obviously people who are having panic attacks will reduce their behaviour, they won't go out so much, they may not engage with people in their lives, their suffering therefore increases, there's a big burden on the NHS, they're admitted to A&E more, the list is endless, it can just go on and on and on. I don't want to go too much into that right now. Right, also, this sort of approach is so we are better able to treat these disorders, so we're arriving at the right therapeutic intervention the first time, fulfilling the NHS criteria of right treatment, right time, least intrusive. So in the IACT programme, the step care model is we're supposed to, as mental health practitioners, see the person within 6 weeks, assess them, get them the right level of care immediately. Well, this isn't happening, particularly in sort of Blackburn, for instance. Lancashire Care, who had the contract up there, had to hand over a huge amount of people from the waiting list because they were waiting up to 24 months. It's 2 years. For help with anxiety and panic disorder, which meant that obviously it was just getting worse and worse and worse. Anyway, And there was elements of the revolving door where they get treated just for the anxiety with self-help, which wasn't appropriate, and then they'd go off and they'd come back again. So although CBT and these sort of interventions are efficacious in the short term, long-term study isn't quite there yet. Also, interdisciplinary contributions such as helping differentiate whether functional disabilities, for example, the reduced activity and changes in behaviour due to underlying breathlessness, or another disorder. So, in A&E departments, a lot of people, I can't remember the exact figure off the top of my head, will go into A&E complaining of breathlessness. I think it's like 25% of people who go in have the symptom of breathlessness. And it's really, really hard for them to distinguish whether this is an episode of a panic attack or, you know, whether it's an episode of something else, something very, very serious. Next, I'd like to use this forum and, you know, anyone's ideas to address the need for a more detailed account of the subjective structures of dyspnea raised by clinicians and researchers. And again, as I mentioned, anxiety is often comorbid with respiratory disease. Redressing this fact by IAP's own admittance that despite mounting evidence for the efficacy of mental health interventions, you know, patient-led collaborative care, there was still this lack of communication between mental health services and general medicine. In fact, the mental health conditions were rarely treated. Well, even though they have this massive amount of evidence showing actually if you treat their mental health issues, we can improve their lifestyle, we can improve the underlying physical conditions, we can improve their social interaction and reduce their suffering, it's rarely treated. I just find that really interesting. Perhaps other people don't. So an example, I've been talking about panic disorder, so just in case anyone wants to know what panic disorder is, panic attacks are, the reason that I've been using it in my talk is one of the main parts of panic is the sensations of shortness of breath or smothering, the feeling of choking, the chest pain and discomfort. So very, very much shared with dyspnea in respiratory disorders. Okay, so this is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So panic attacks come about unpredictably. So with people with COPD, it's really difficult for them to be able to distinguish between an acute respiratory event that needs them to go to hospital immediately, or is it down to a panic attack? So in mental health, we can equip people with mindfulness techniques, we can help breathing retraining, we can slow the breathing down, all of these different types of therapeutic interventions that we have, but actually without people with these conditions even knowing that that their attacks aren't down to panic, their attacks are down to COPD in their opinion, they're just going to keep going to hospital and they're going to potentially reduce their life world even further and their distress and not exercise, because every time they go out somewhere they might experience, you know, this breathlessness. Okay, so briefly moving on to intentionality, because I think I might be running out of time. Intentionality harks back to phenomenology and philosophers such as Brentano. We also have Husserl, Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty. I'm not going to go into the history of intentionality or distinguish it from intentionality in philosophy of mind. Needless to say, intentionality is also called, also comes with consciousness is always conscious of something. So when you're thinking about something, I believe that if I don't leave this room immediately, I'm going to stop breathing. That's the aboutness, there's a content to what I'm thinking about. So this is very mental, it's very aboutness, it's very, my thoughts are directed about something, my emotions are directed towards something, there's an intentional object, okay? So it's not a metaphysical claim about what exists out there. I can think about a unicorn. A unicorn doesn't have to exist. That's the concept of intentionality, okay? So, as I was saying, my fear of dying may be completely inappropriate and down to my panic disorder. What we call in CBT is a catastrophic misinterpretation of bodily events. So I feel short of breath, I've got palpitations. I ascribe irrational thoughts to those instead of actually, shaking myself and going, don't be silly, don't be anxious and panicking about this talk. You'd be absolutely fine. It overrides you physiologically, okay? So, is it explanation? Am I describing things? Here, I'm just saying, phenomenology does not need to explain how breathlessness is caused. We have medicine for that. We have wonderful researchers on that. Rather, phenomenology is free to describe the experience of breathlessness without any theoretical metaphysical commitments. We can provide a clear case of a phenomenon or experience that needs to be explained by utilising concepts such as intentionality. So, really, by doing this, what I'm trying to do is study so that I can get a detailed account of the experience which may guide research and explanation into these different disorders to do with breathlessness. Okay, so as I was saying, intentionality concept, that was quite mental. I was talking about beliefs, desires, wants, emotions. Merleau-Ponty talks about motor intentionality and intentional art. Now, I know Javi's covered this, and we don't have loads of time, but just briefly to say, it's not just these mental phenomena that are cognitions, for instance, that have intentionality. For Merleau-Ponty, the body is directed, it's goal-directed, it has motor intentionality. We can achieve things through movement, our body is directed towards things. I need to drink water, for example. So there's a little bit about bodily intentionality. Now, the unity of the body is shown through this meaningful action, and we can make sense of an anxious person's attempts to breathe slowly and deeply, despite the fact there's no real threat here, and through observing their behaviour. So I'm stumbling over my words a little bit, because I am really anxious. It's my first time here. So you can see that I'm anxious. You can look at my bodily intentionality and see what I'm doing. Very, very quickly, because I'm going to run out of time. The body, then, is the foundation of motor intentionality. Consciousness is being towards the thing through the intermediary of the body. To move one's body is to aim at things through it. I'm not going to talk about the intentional art because I'm going to run out of time. But this sort of intentionality is will avoid the mind-body dichotomy. I'm going to have to skip this, I'm afraid. So, practical considerations to finish with. In mental health practice and with NICE guidelines, we need to sort of start addressing the needs of the thousands, maybe millions of untreated and undertreated patients with COPD, comorbid with mental health and physical conditions. So, my clinical supervisor from the north of England and I were talking the other day about how when we would have someone in the clinic with respiratory distress and diagnosed respiratory disorders, we couldn't utilise things such as behavioural experiments like hyperventilation or exposure to anxious situations because doctors wouldn't take on that responsibility or let us take on the risk factor because if you intentionally get somebody with respiratory distress to hyperventilate, bad things could happen. But there's a wealth of therapeutic interventions that does work, and that, again, I have to be aware of, that we could use. But there needs to be a collaboration between the GPs or, you know, the other physical health practitioners and mental health. So this will alleviate suffering and redress the fact that untreated depression and anxiety in chronic health problems actually worsen health outcomes, increase healthcare spending, but it's the suffering of the individuals who are not given a platform to describe their a voice, even to describe what's going on with them, and to stand up and to actually get the help that is out there, but is very difficult to access. So I'm going to have to leave the rest of it.
To capture the phenomenology of what it means to be living with a life-limiting illness. And I was thinking that really this is about, perhaps, about developing through your qualitative research of what it means for the individual to experience debilitating breathlessness. Through gathering that information, we can develop better tools. So it seems to me that there's something about correct assessment. And we've had the same stuff with pain, you know, the words that we use to do, that are on the forms, you know, the Gill pain questionnaire, are prescriptive. You know, there's no box to write in what you're feeling. So I think we really need to be thinking about how we assess people, how we bring the language from mental health into our assessment of breathlessness, so that we can correctly capture exactly what you want to capture. Because then when we have the baseline, when we can work out who's experiencing what, then we can work out how to treat it and develop and pilot and get funding for treatments, and then, you know, off we go, sort of thing. So
absolutely, absolutely. And the total dyspnea model has a similar sort of framework going on there as well. I know it's not in palliative care, but yeah, no, absolutely.
And do you know the Cambridge Breathlessness Service and Sarah Booth's work?
Yes. This came up before, and yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
When you talked about a little bit about hyperventilation and then the question of intentionality, and you talked about body's intentionality, and you mentioned the intentional art. Do you see that breath itself is an intentionality relation to the world? And you were talking about the intentionality of the body towards the things, but as the breath is not towards a thing, but some kind of atmosphere, does it have its own intentionality or not? And what kind of intentionality that would be?
That's a really interesting question. I have to think about that. I was thinking of it in terms of, you know, trying to look at intentionality and the breakdown. I wanted to talk about the breakdown in the intentional arc in people's situation, the problems in culture, etc., etc. But absolutely, what you're saying makes absolute sense. But it's something that I'd have to really think about. Breath, intentionality in breath. That's really, really interesting.
I think it's something to do with the breath fueling the intentionality. I think the breath is the fuel. That's, and then again, I sort of it over my head, but not when you ask that question, I see the breath as the fuel for doing what you want to do. Does that make sense?
I just wanted to say that for Merleau Ponty, it would be an organic intentionality, something that happens like the focusing on the eye. It talks about an organic intentionality rather than a kind of
I mean, in a sense, there that the eye normally looks at the thing, but the breath doesn't have a connection to a thing in the similar sense. Yeah. But then the difference of this to the atmosphere and to the thing, like what kind of intentionality difference there is.
I think one of the big differences is that we're not aware of our breathing until something's going wrong. So it seems to be not purposive in the same way that, you know, looking at an object is purposive.
Something doesn't have to be going wrong.
All right.
All right. Something that, I mean, we're talking about this in the break, or a change in the pattern which suddenly makes you conscious of your breathing. Mm. So some change, but it's not always wrong. Yeah. There is usually something going wrong. But therefore, conceptually, it seems very different from what happens in vision and in our, and indeed that conscious intentionality when we're looking at what we think about to discriminate.
Yeah, but Melopontis' point is that we automatically know our eyes sort of automatically focus. We don't have to think about how I focus my eye. He gives us very example that we can stand in front of a painting and know exactly what the right distance for looking at it is, and it's not a rational cognitive, in that sense, intentional process, but rather that our body adjusts to the world in a kind of organic way, and I suppose that's the kind of intentionality that Melopontis are
talking about. And that's the feeling.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to move on because it's a fascinating discussion. Let's thank Zina once more for that.